welcome to Four Guys One Up episode 17 for Friday, February. What day is it? It's 12.
Do you need some help there? Do you need an assist on the mic?
I think we got some assist.
And how can it be four guys if there are three guys and one empty mic?
This is a running gag. I think the empty mic will be playing the role of Matt Leone today.
Oh, excellent.
He was going to be here, but he's got another appointment, couldn't make it.
Let me handle that for you real quickly. God of War 3 will be awesome.
Did you see the new trailer?
It's going to be awesome.
Did you see the new
God
trailer?
God of War is awesome.
New trailer looked awesome. So enough.
Now that we have the Matt Leone segment out of the way.
Enough of me, who my voice is shattered. It's gone. Of course, you
it's
know.
It's kind of brusque. I like it. It's very sexy.
Bit. I thought about being Brad Shoemaker from Giant Bomb.
Dude, you can't do Brad.
Okay.
You can't do Brad. Brad is his own level of excellence.
I can only produce an homage to Brad.
Oh, excellent.
There we go.
Well done.
So, of course, that is the one and only Mr. Garnet Lee.
Hello, everybody.
Back in town and on the mic.
This is a fun place. I like this.
Yes.
Looks familiar.
I think it does. And joining us today is Mr. Justin Haywald, our reviews editor here at 1UP.
Howdy ho.
And the reason we're here is we're going to do kind of a recap of X10, which went on this week. If you're paying attention to the game space, you've been inundated with news stories, videos.
What if you're not paying attention?
Well, then we'll keep you up to date on it, and you'll find out everything that did happen.
You probably had no idea that it even happened at all. It was such a star-studded event.
I never saw the first X's 1 through 9.
X's 1 through 9. They were low-budget films.
All right. So X10, if you don't know what it is, was the Microsoft kind of basically a spring showcase for their games. Kind of it seemed to indicate, you talking through people throughout the night, that they're doing this so that they can really focus on Natal and those types of games for E3.
Yes. This was a non-Natal show. I mean, it was –
Natal.
They were very clear about that. There's no Natal here. We're not talking about Natal. We're focusing on the games.
Right. And while we were at the event, I was able to record a couple of interviews with some of the devs. And while we started out with Fable 3, got a chance to talk with Peter Molyneux. We're going to throw it to a quick interview we recorded with him in his like downstairs pleasure palace they had set up for interviews. It's pretty amazing, complete with white shag carpeting. So
did it stay white?
It did stay white. Ooh.
Well, then you did not have a good enough time, obviously.
Peter's pure of heart, so.
Yeah, well, and of intent.
Especially intent. So we'll throw that interview. We'll come back, talk a little bit about Fable 3.
Well, it is late in the night, X10. I've been here for several hours. You've been here as well.
Journalists, alcohol, jet lag, I mean, all those things, they're not a good mix. Yeah.
So you might recognize that voice. Mine's going away, so ignore me for the time being. That is, of course, Peter Molyneux, the head of Lionhead and Xbox in Europe.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. Yes, it's big. These big titles, they're there. I mean, actually, I'm an obsessive compulsive, so I just obsess about things. At the moment, I'm obsessing about Fable and Fable 3. And so, you know, I think of myself as, you know, at this time, as very much a designer and very much a director, and, you know, that's the way I work. But then I have this wider role, which is, you know, helping, you know, guide, just in a, you know, life's like advisory role, you know, other products in Europe, which is exciting to see.
So we had a quote leading up to X10 that you felt that there was going to be something that would upset gamers. So based on what you saw.
Right. Yeah, you know, this has turned into some, you know, like, Uber PR strategy.
That's what I thought. That was my question.
You know, that sneaky, crafty Peter Molyneux, he's said these things. Yeah. Here's the reality. This is actually what happened. The scene was me standing in minus 15 temperatures in Copenhagen waiting for a cab. I'm standing next to someone who is obviously a journalist. I didn't realize, of course, the power of Twitter means that he can Twitter anything I say within seconds of me saying it. We're talking about game design. And I'm saying, you know, talking about Fable 3, I'm saying, you know what? You know, when you design games, sometimes you have to make decisions that are going to really upset people. I think I use the word pissed off, actually. Yeah. And with Fable 3, you know, people are going to get upset about some things that have been changed. I'd never in a thousand years thought that that would then be the center of the PR strategy for the entire thing of Fable 3. And it's kind of fitted, but it is amazing now how the world's changed, you know, in terms of reporting and stuff like that.
Well, I've noticed you've been using Twitter more today than you have in the last several months.
Really, he bullied me into using Twitter, and I, you know, I'm desperate to get back onto Twitter and say amusing things.
Yeah. Someone yell, are you about talking about Aurora yet or not?
are you still okay?
No, I've been yelled at already, and you know, oh, I thought we were saving Aurora for some, you know, unbeknown PR event later on. But you know, as I said to them, what is so hard when you're actually talking through, you know, a game design, and people are asking you really smart, intelligent questions like, why did you do this, and what about that? You can't keep on saying, well, I can't tell you about that, and you know, that's a secret, because it, you end up, you know, not telling the real, you know, full story. To wind back to your original question is why, what I've done to upset people, and we're really what, you know, it is that we've pulled out of Fable 3 things like it, the experience system. There is no experience system anymore.
Even beneath the kind of thing, or is it just taken away?
You know, the whole idea of experience. Now, what experience is in role-playing games and in Fable 1 and Fable 2, it was the reward you got for combat. Mm-hmm. But where it didn't work is you didn't get any rewards for making, you know, for building up relationships with people. And we really need to think of one value which you know, which fitted into the entirety of the game and all the experience that you got for you got for doing expressions, you got for getting married, you got for doing quests, you got for doing things called extended expressions and speeches, you got when you were king, you got when you were on the journey to king. And as soon as you say the word followers, and that everything you do in the game, including the things that you wear, has the potential to get you more followers or lose you followers, you realize that experience is just wrong. Same with the health bar. You know, the health bar in Fable 3, when we first designed it, was this minuscule line at the top of the left-hand side of the screen. You kind of realize, you know, who is going to look at this health bar? You know, who is even going to glance at it? We should just do what FPSs do and put a health bar into the world, so the screen changes and dissolves if, you know, when your health is getting low, because that's more dramatic. It kind of makes sense, but, you know, there are people that are going to, you know, say, oh my God, I'm, you know, my health bar, I loved the health bar, it was the best health bar in the world, and I love the color and everything. There you go.
Have you considered or tested it out on people who perhaps might be colorblind that might not be able to notice the transitions in the screen?
Oh my God, I forgot about colorblind people. Damn, we'll have to go back to the thing. Well, I actually didn't tell you the way that we're kind of visualizing, you know, you getting close to death. You know, I think there is almost a standard in the industry now about red borders on the screen and going black and white. I'm not saying that Fable is going to be exactly like that. I think you'll be going to be okay if you're colorblind, let's say that much.
I'm curious about the state of Lionhead, because you mentioned you're spending most of your time on Fable right now. Are there other people spending most of their time on Milo?
Yeah, Milo is still very much a project that's, you know, that's going on at Lionhead, and you know, there's a pretty big team working on it, and you know, it's absolutely amazing and incredible now what you're seeing. I mean, the tiny sort of inch-wise slither that you saw of Milo really, you know, doesn't really give you a clue to what it actually is. But it's, you know, it's very, very unique and very, very different. Yeah.
We haven't heard much from out of Rare since, you know, Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts.
Avatar is impossibly that tall, but what is Rare up to beside that? Are they going to be... Do you think they'll be doing another disc-based regular game like how you would be doing with Fable?
So the only thing I can tell you is that, and you know, it would be totally inappropriate for me to talk in about any of their content, except to say there are very, very, very smart, clever people there. I mean, you know, I'm incredibly smart and clever people there, and you know, smart and clever people work on amazing and incredible things. So A plus B equals smart, brilliant things. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Is there anything else in development at Lionhead, or is it strictly those two projects right now?
Certainly those are the only projects that the world has any knowledge about, yes.
So there are things the world has no knowledge about.
There's three guys.
Yes, possibly. Well, no, I mean, here's the thing about Lionhead. There's always more things going on than actually we talk about. You know, yeah, we're really focusing on Fable 3. Yes, Milo is, you know, still going on. But we have this experimental culture and this, you know, prototyping culture, which is always, you know, bubbling up new things. We used to talk about those things. That's what Project Dimitri was about. We don't talk about them anymore because we're sensible people now rather than hypey people. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some very exciting experiments going. No, more, no, we don't do those horrible mistakes anymore, for sure. No, definitely not.
If you were to reduce Fable 3 down to like kind of a genre, a base level genre, how would you describe it at this point in time? You've pulled things away from it.
That's a very interesting thing. I mean, you know, I think if you said RPG, is there enough of RPGs in there to still call it an RPG? Well, the thing about it is there is the most important thing about RPG for me is leveling up. That's what I love about RPGs, man. I love the idea of leveling up, of getting more powerful, of feeling my character grow. And for me, that's the core of what RPGs is. And that's a real difference between, you know, an RPG and then, you know, something like, you know, a kind of an action adventure where you've got, you know, this pre-canned hero and this hero is it. This is what you get. That leveling up still exists. But I think there are elements of action-adventure games about drama and emotional connection and edge-of-your-seat stuff, which I think Fable is much, much more close to. So, you know, if you've never seen Fable before, I'm not sure you would call it an RPG, to be honest with you.
This week we released a review for Quantic Dream's Heavy Rain. I'm curious, you know, another European developer, have you had a chance to play Heavy Rain at all, or do you know much about it?
Yeah, I saw Heavy Rain. I mean, the first time I saw Heavy Rain was a long, long time ago, where there was this amazing cinematic moment with this woman sitting at a table. And then the last time I saw it was last E3. When I played it, I thought, okay, I don't really get the connection with the first thing I saw. But I have heard from a lot of people that there's some really good emotional moments, especially in the early part of the game.
Actually, similar to that, among the many improvements and mechanics that Fable 2 brought, I think the biggest takeaway was a dog that didn't know you, but actually a dog that you loved. Yeah. So what would you know, that was like the takeaway of Fable 2. What would you summarize, boil down the takeaway of Fable 3 to be?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think the brilliant thing about the dog is it was a dog and it felt like a dog, and for that reason it just shows that if you want to get this emotional connection, so you know, it's not just about brilliant writing or, you know, characters. It is, computer games are different to films, and I think when this is a philosophical discussion, we could go on for hours talking about this. When people, you know, because I've met a lot of people from the film world now, you know, a lot, and some of them are very famous people. And when they talk about the film world, they always talk about, hey, you've got a characterization, and you've got to understand, have empathy with it, and, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, I keep saying to them is, well, yeah, but we can cheat, because we can give you a real dog. And the very fact that we can give you a real dog and it's yours, it's an emotional connection. Now, with Fable 3, it's the touch, man. It is absolutely amazing what it feels like. And let me give you one small example without you seeing the demo that gives you it. So touch, what you can do, because it's highly context sensitive to the situation that's going on and the emotional state of the thing that you're touching, there's some brilliant, wonderful things that can happen. For example, when you are in Fable 3, it's all about half the game's the journey to rule, and then the other half of the game is about being ruler. When you're ruler, someone can come to you and they can ask you to fulfill one of the promises that you gave before you were king. You can use the touch system at that point, and then you can grab this person by the scruff of the neck and you can drag them to your dungeon and you can throw them in there. Now, the very fact that you're doing that and you can feel that, you know, the pull on them, and that as you're dragging them through, they say, no, please, please, if you throw me now, I'm never going to come out. I've got a family, I've got children. Please, please don't hurt me. I didn't mean, you know, sire, you know, I will go back and I, you know, please just spare me. The very fact that they do that is just going to make you feel, just for one second, just slightly guilty. Now, compare that to the way it worked in Fable 2. You go up to the person, press A to throw him in the dungeon, or B to let him off. There's no emotional connection. And just like the dog, the dog proves that if you do these simple things these simple things that are not cutscene based, they're part of the gameplay, then the emotional connection that people can get is 10 times what there was there before. You know, another example we showed in the demo was that you find your daughter been playing on the streets and she's, you know, kind of run away from home. You can use an expression to kind of tell her off, and, you know, bad girl, and then she starts crying. You use the touch mechanic, context sensitivity, and because it's your daughter, you pick her up and you just hug her. And that's the thing. How many times have you seen contact between characters in a computer game? Very, very rarely. Now it's under your control. It's all about your power, your emotional connection that you decide to have. And that's why touch is a huge thing, I think. And I'll probably be beaten up for it. And I'm probably, you know, the community can say, well, it's just your hand reaching out. And what does that mean? But, you know, just like the dog, you have to experience it. It is a big thing. It does make a difference. And, you know, for me, it makes a huge difference to Fable.
I think we only have time for one more question. I wanted to ask before we go, when you initially talked about Fable 2, the cooperative aspect was something that you talked up a lot. And I have to say, when I did play it, I was a little disappointed and it was a little limited. But is that something that's still important for you for Fable 3, even though it's a story based on you can only have one king in a kingdom? Is co-op still a part of Fable 3?
Okay, yes, I heard you all about co-op. You wanted to have your own hero come into the world. Okay, fine, you can have that, definitely. So co-op, when you come into my world, you come in as your hero with your dog, with all your unique weapons, self-crafted weapons. I heard you. You don't want to be tied to my camera. You want to go off and do your own thing in my world. Fine, fair enough. You wanted that. There are going to be consequences. It means careful who you invite in, because they can screw the whole thing up, man. Fine. If you wanted it, you have it. You co-op. You can come into my world. You can be, you know, you can be customizing the house or doing the job or buying something in a shop while I'm out questing. If you want to come in into my co-op world and you want, if we really get on well together, we should be able to get married. Absolutely, yeah, fine. As you in co-op game, the first co-op game only, you can truly get married. Yes, you can use touch with your co-op partner. Yes, you can walk down the street hand in hand. Yes, you can drag your co-op partner to your dungeon and see what happens. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Peter, well, it's been a long day. Yeah. Thank you very much for taking some time and talking with us.
Yeah, pleasure.
So that was Mr. Molyneux, and of course my once supple vocal cords.
Supple vocal cords?
I don't think I like the sound of that.
That sounds kind of creepy.
It does sound really creepy, man.
Take two on that. Well, the location we were interviewing him, like I said earlier, was a little creepy.
So, you know, that's Peter being Peter, and he always has that idea, like we were talking about on the way back from lunch, you know, like Martin from IGN UK.
Yeah.
He had the best explanation of Peter. He's like, there's the game on the screen that Peter's demoing, and then there's the game he's describing. And it's like the game that he's describing is really awesome. It's the game in his imagination. And then you just kind of have to wait to see how much of that will actually translate eventually to the game on the screen.
Yeah. I mean, Justin, you and Garnet, you both saw Fable 3. Of course, there was a story leading into it that he was going to show something that was going to piss people off. And we finally, in the interview, you got the context of how that quote got out there and everything. And he was trying to assure us that it wasn't this masterful PR stroke to like and make people expect the worst. So that when he did announce it, everyone's like, oh, that's not so bad. That's actually pretty good. What did you think of seeing Fable 3 for the first time?
Well, I was surprised. I think a lot of people going into this thought that this was going to be a Natal showcase game, that was going to be the thing that would piss us off.
That's what a lot of people thought. But Garnet steadfastly said, no, that wasn't the case. In fact, you correctly predicted what it was, which was basically
taking out the experience system.
Yep.
He sort of telegraphed that because he had already said, hey, I'm going to change, you know, when we were at Gamescom, he said, I'm going to change the foundation of games. I'm going to do something that is, you know, we've looked at RPGs and they've always been doing the same thing. We've been caught in this design that's never been challenged, and we're going to challenge that. And so the challenge to that is that now it's based off of your followers and reputation, how you improve yourself. And then the thing with the with the weaponization system,
yeah,
which is pretty crazy for an RPG. I'm curious to see how well that works out.
It sounds interesting, yeah.
It's calling it an RPG, but it's always been a very Zelda-like experience. And I think this is just pushing it even more in that way. This is pushing it more towards an adventure and less of an RPG.
So in the interview we conducted, that was actually one of the questions I asked him. I said, to break this game down to a genre, would you still describe it as a RPG? And he didn't really answer the question, which I thought was interesting. So I think you're right. It's definitely going to a more action kind of oriented space.
Do we really need to stick a name on it for genre? I don't really care what you call it.
Well, I don't know. I think the person going to buy a game in the store, they need some familiarity so they can expect what
it's a fantasy adventure game.
I think that's as good an explanation as any. But the one thing that I had heard is that in addition to the weapons thing, it'll actually base some of the weapon stuff based on your achievements outside of the game. Your gamer score.
Yeah, you said your gamer score does have some effect on what your weapons
did he show
like.
You guys what that was? Because he showed us in the demo that I got what that amounts
no,
to.
No, he didn't. I didn't get.
I think like your weapons shoot out like different effects or something.
So your weapon that you're using is everything in the morph system. So originally in the first game, they had this morph system where as you built your character up, then they would buff up. And one of the responses they had to that was they only had like this one morphing model where your character would either get big and burly, which people were like, what did he call it? He called it the Russian shot put lady look. Like, all due respect to anyone Russian shot putters who might be listening. And what they wanted to do was expand on that and have it more reflective of what's going on in the game. So I have to explain it's like the whole system because then it will make sense where he's going with
this. There is a video out there. They did release an inside Lionhead video which showed it off with like the wings and stuff.
So you use different weapons and which weapon you use depends on what sort of body type you develop. So if you're using this massive two-handed sort of, you know, like one of the things they showed was this long pole arm of some sort that had like a big axe blade on the end of it, then you're going to get burly if you use that. I mean, you know, if you go to the other end of the spectrum and use like a rapier or something, you're going to stay lithe and thin and you'll be very flexible and quick. So the weapons also do this morphing based on how you use them. So the weapon he showed that had this axe head on it, he had been using that to kill a lot of Hobbs. Mm-hmm. And so it was taking on characteristics of the Hobbs. The outline of the axe head started to reflect some of the signature character elements of the Hobbs with, you know, with plates and almost like it almost looked like a silhouette of a Hobbs head on there. So the gamer score thing figures in where it looks at the gamer score that you have. And if I understood correctly, it's your Fable 3 achievements gamer score, not your overall gamer score.
Okay, because I was told differently, but yeah.
Someone asked that question in the session, and he said that it's the Fable 3 achievements and the score that you have from them.
Okay,
and then that adds additional detailing to the weapon. So all sorts of crazy crap happens with the weapon. The weapon, for instance, if you kill a lot of innocents, might start like dripping blood. and where the gamer score comes in is it adds detailing. And he showed on the sword where one of the guys, the guy who was demoing, I forget his name. I think he's the producer on the game.
Unfortunately, I missed the entire demo.
So he's a nice guy. Anyway, so he showed his sword. He equipped that and his gamer score had resulted in some I guess like additional spikes down by the hilt guard.
Well, one of the things they said is they want everyone ideally to have a completely unique weapon to use in the game. They want everyone to have something that looks and feels a little bit different.
Did he get into the trading part? Because then you can take.
He talked about that you're able to trade this with anybody else, and it's always going to have your name. It's going to be a specific weapon to you, no matter who's wielding it anywhere else in the world.
But then it keeps morphing however they use it, which is really weird.
The good thing there is that the trading would indicate, and in the interview we talked a little bit about the co-op in Fable 3, and you know. He's promising that it'll actually be what they were promising in Fable 2, where you do have legitimate consequences if you bring someone into your world that they can completely screw you over. You can kind of go anywhere and do anything. You're not held on like the one person's camera.
Yeah,
none of that
camera.
Stuff. Kind of drop in, drop out stuff. So if they pull it off and actually make it work, I'll be happy because that was my biggest. I like Fable 2, but my biggest disappointment was the GIMP co-op system in it.
Really? That was okay.
I didn't finish it though. I've heard the story goes a little awry later in the game.
I liked the story quite a bit, and I'm interested to see how this is going to play out with Teresa, with all the stuff that they built up from Fable 1.
I guess I should go back and finish Fable 2. I don't know.
I want to now. So I guess
the ending is really cool. I think the ending gets a bad rap. I thought the ending itself was really cool. You're standing, you're looking at the last. I'm not going to ruin it, but you're standing, you're looking at the last bad guy. And if you play as a good character, you get a really cool ending, I think.
Ah,
it was really
bad ending. That's bad.
Well, if you play as an evil character, if you play as an evil character, you might not even realize that this thing would happen at the end.
Huh. Ah. That's interesting.
Well, another game that we actually already know the ending going into it was Halo Reach, which...
yeah, you know exactly how it ends, which yes. I think was one of the cool parts that they finally it brought out. And you know, we all knew already, hey, this is a story that doesn't end well.
Yeah.
And they did talk about how they want to emphasize that, and that's part of the drama they want to bring into the game is, hey, there's 700 million people living on Reach. What the heck happens to them when it all goes to hell?
Yeah, so before we get into too much of the detail of Halo Reach, we did get a chance to talk with Brian Gerard and Marcus Lehto, who's the creative director there at Bungie, about the game. Got to ask him a few questions. So we'll play that first and then talk about it afterwards.
You guys have been here since early this morning. I'm here with Brian Gerard, Marcus Lehto. Lehto.
See, it's a Finnish name.
Third time's a charm. Of course, we have Matt Leone and Scooter here. So today was the first time we got a chance to see Halo Reach in the kind of on screen and everything. Been a little bit of controversy out there about some specific qualification on multiplayer maps as it relates to campaign maps. What is the official statement on the maps, the multiplayer maps, and how they relate to campaign spaces?
Well, the official response is that we're not delving into all the details of multiplayer yet. This is the tip of the iceberg. But the core of the multiplayer map offering is based on the fiction, and they are grounded in campaign spaces. And I think I'm just going to leave it at that for right now. So people shouldn't get too spun up. There's a long time between now and launch, and we obviously have a lot more to talk about. So
got a lot more in there. Brian's right. We just scratched the surface tonight. And, I hope people don't get spun up about that, because that's the least of the things they should be worrying about. I mean, there's so many other good things within the game overall that we're going to be offering. And that it'll, like I said, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
All right, so I have been paying attention to what a lot of the hardcore fans are saying out there, and for whatever reason, I get this question a lot from people. Are you guys changing the field of view at all with Halo Reach? Specifically as it compares to like the Halo 3 field of view or the ODST field of view.
Is that fair game?
I don't even know the answer to that question, Marcus.
Okay. We did take some liberties with changing field of view, changing some of the player mechanics. Like we did with ODST as well. We understood that for Reach, we wanted that gameplay experience, because one of the things we're doing was actually having players play through more human-scale environments, and that actually does require us to do a little bit more with what we're doing with the FOV. Player speed, jump height, those kind of things. We did subtly tune them, so they work just perfectly for Reach.
Anything? I don't want to steal everything.
I just have a somewhat nerdy question.
Asked about field of view. I don't think it's going to get nerdier than that.
This gets into like story lore content. You know, when looking at the backgrounds of Noble Team, and Noble 6 has a highly redacted, like classified background. Is there an actual like canon story to Noble 6, or is it simply for the player to define what Noble 6 is by their actions?
Well, we have written backstory for Noble 6.
So will that be revealed in the course of Reach then?
It may.
I was just wondering if there's like a purposeful actual story to him, or that is simply he's a blank slate so players can be as cool as they make Noble 6 to be.
Well, to some degree. I mean, that's absolutely true. We're giving Noble 6 more of your ability to jump into the skin of that character and really make them your own. But there is a history to that that we purposely wrote in order to have the other Spartan Noble Team members interact with you in the story in a more believable way.
So why do we have all Spartan 3 except for one Spartan 2? Why is there one Spartan 2 in there? Is it so that the really hardcore fans can say there's a legitimate Spartan there? It's not.
Like, I'm too old for this shit, guy.
So why not all Spartan 3s?
Well, we felt like this was an opportunity for us to play with the flavor and character of each one of the Noble Team Spartans that reaches the home of both the Spartan 2 and Spartan 3 programs. So it had all of that good stuff just waiting for us to play around with. And we really wanted one of these characters to really help stand out and be a little bigger than life than some of the other characters. And we decided, you know what, this is a perfect opportunity for us to make George 052 the only one with Spartan 2 credentials. So it worked out pretty well for us. And we're definitely bringing logic to it overall through the story, so it makes sense.
So So one of the concept art that has been out there is the character of Kat. One of the concept art, she has two pistols. She has one on each hip. Is there anything we should read out of that?
Mistake.
So, concept and creative liberty.
It's a painting, yeah. No.
So, I mean, I don't know if you guys can talk about it, but I mean, will there be dual wielding in Reach? There wasn't in ODST. Of course, there was in 2 and
there
3.
There will be no dual wielding. No.
It's a prequel, right? I mean, yeah. No one had learned how to dual wield yet, so.
She had it in her concept, but she couldn't figure it out.
Can you elaborate at all about Rob McLean's comment that, like, civilians will have a bigger role in Reach?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, part of the meat of this story is the fact that there are 700 million innocent civilians on this planet, and that many of them are going to die because the Covenant destroyed this planet. So it was really we put a lot of effort into bringing that civilian culture to life, and you will definitely see civilians play alongside civilians and understand their story a little bit, so you can connect with it and have some understanding of what Reach was really all about, and have some understanding of what's so special about it, so you care about it.
So this question was given and solicited by someone on one of the message boards. I'm actually forgetting his name at the moment, so I don't want to even try to say the wrong one. But he said that, you know, kind of the role of the Flood in the Halo games was kind of change up combat compared to just a Covenant that you fought so much. And in Reach, all we've seen is Covenant forces. There are different types of Covenant forces, but how do you keep the encounters with these Covenant forces interesting throughout the entire course of a full Halo campaign?
Well, with Reach, we're definitely revisualizing the Covenant. We want them to feel a little bit fresher than what we've ever seen them before. We're giving brand new characters to the Covenant that you've never seen before. We're giving the existing Covenant complete facelifts from the ground up in many cases. We're giving them brand new abilities and new things to do. But that said, I mean, we are definitely taking a look holistically at the campaign and understanding that we're not going to throw the same thing at the player encounter after encounter. We're actually taking the player through experiences that they've never been through in a Halo game before in order to make sure that it stays fresh and it stays alive all the way through from beginning to end.
You know, one of the last questions that I wanted to ask is, it is a kind of a multiplayer question again, but I know you guys can't talk too much about it, but I can ask anyway. You mentioned that the perspectives is a little different. The height of the character, the human characters, is a little different. Is that going to affect the type of characters that you can select to play as in multiplayer? Specifically, like, height of Elite versus a Spartan 3?
Well, that's a good question. The Spartans are actually a little bit shorter than the Master Chief. And the Elites are taller. That definitely plays into the mechanics of each one of those characters. Absolutely. And we're playing with that. We're actually having a good time making sure that actually balances well together in multiplayer.
Yeah, I got one. I remember hearing a while ago, I think before Reach was announced, that Jason Jones had been incubating some secret project. Is this that project? Like, is he one of the main guys on this game?
No, I don't think that's the project that we were talking about. I mean, I should say that Jason's a creative director of our whole studio. So, I mean, everybody at Bungie sort of has their hand in the pot, but, you know, Marcus is the creative project lead for Reach. But Jason and a core of people are actually at the helm of what will be Bungie's next big thing, and it's been in development, you know, in various forms for a little while now, and it still happens to go in parallel with Reach, but the full firepower of Bungie's clearly focused on getting Reach out the door, making it awesome, but we do have other stuff underway, and it's something non-Halo and totally new, and when the time comes, we look forward to talking about it.
There have been quotes out there that perhaps this is the last Halo game, at least it's the last Halo game that Bungie will probably be making anytime soon. Have you thought about kind of what emotions are going to be there that last day you're sending it out for certification? It's that this baby that you guys have, like, put years and years of your life into. What is that emotion going to be like when you have to hand it off to...
Marcus tearing up right now already. Look.
I will weep. No, definitely. No,
I can't be there to film it.
No, it's sad. I mean, yeah, this is our last big hurrah to Halo. So, and I've worked on it since 1997. Jason and I were in the same room building Halo together. We started this franchise with just a very few number of people. And so we've seen it grow to, you know, unimaginable size. I mean, we never knew it was going to be this big. And so, yeah, we're putting everything we've got into Halo Reach. And yeah, I'm really sad to see. I'm gonna be sad to see it go.
Walking your daughter down the aisle.
And yeah, I am.
Is Frankie the person giving away the bride? Is that what's working here?
Oh God, don't start.
All right, guys, so it's late. Thank you for taking some time out to talk with us. I really appreciate it. Marcus, Brian, we'll see you next time.
All right, thank you. Thank you
very much. So, yeah, that was the very late night interview with Brian. I think and Marcus, I think we were their last one. We were just basically standing around in front of their demo station with a stick mic just talking.
Like, could you guys be done and get out of here?
Well, they looked exhausted. And, of course, the irony is those guys have been talking all day, and I'm the asshole whose voice has gone away. But it was a good chat, and got to learn a little bit more about – I mean, the thing that the hardcore Halo fans fixated on out of that demo was the kind of throwaway statement they made that the multiplayer maps would be coming from single-player environments and locations. And,
which is cool, I think. The hardcore doesn't like that?
Well, they're afraid that the multiplayer maps will be a little more generic because they're coming from a campaign experience that has to kind of do everything rather than the really focused multiplayer events. They didn't want to get into all the details on what that actually means.
Well, I would take a step back, though, and look at this game in that it's being designed more around the sort of engagements you had in Halo 1, mm-hmm. where you had two different kinds, they call it two different pipes. You had like the thin pipe where they're controlling you, and then you had the broad pipe where they let you go loose. And I think the thing that a lot of people liked about Halo 1 was you got in these firefights, and they were fun to go back and play because you could play them and get different things to happen all the time based on what the AI was doing.
Yeah.
So keeping that in mind now, if you're going to build this sandbox-style large environment that you're going to have this action take place in, all you're doing is substituting in AI for what would be real players. So when you go online in multiplayer, then obviously you have real people playing those positions. When you're playing in single player, then you have bots and AI playing it. And the other thing is they can play with other things. I mean, they can play with time of day. They can play with environmental effects. It means more time spent polishing a fewer number of maps as opposed to let's build a whole shit ton of maps.
Well, and one of the things that I think they've probably learned a lot from Firefight and the way players interacted with those AI characters in spots and positions, I give Bungie the benefit of the doubt. I mean, they've made some fantastic games over the last, 9-10 years, and they've really, been able to follow through. I will say for me, I went in like visually expecting not much out of it just because the screenshots don't really do it very much justice. But seeing it in motion, I was actually kind of impressed with it looks like what I expected Halo 3 to look like.
That's a good way to put it.
And that's not a knock with what Halo 3 ended up looking like, but just, as a fan of the series, I was expecting just to be on this generation of console to be like, wow. And so seeing Reach, and especially the revamped animation system, especially with the elite enemies and stuff like that, just seeing those motions and the fact that they've changed the field of view of the characters because the Spartan 3s are actually a little shorter than Spartan 2s. And so the elites are actually bigger.
Do they have a Napoleon complex?
I mean, I don't know. I think it's cool just seeing that the elites are bigger and much more menacing than, to me, the brutes ever were, other than like the brute chieftain stuff in Halo 3 with the big hammer. I liked that quite a bit.
It's like the new brute with the Triceratops head or whatever is.
I wanted to boo when they showed the brute on screen just because I don't really like the way they...
So, I mean, I guess that what you're getting at is the reason that they had to do the sort of demo they did. Mm-hmm. I found the demo, I was kind of tuning out during it because it was so fixated on all of the technical elements of it looks pretty, which was basically what it was. I mean, really, to sum up their 10 to 15 minute presentation was it looks a hell of a lot more pretty because we've basically ripped apart the old engine mm-hmm. and built a new engine. We were talking about this earlier. It's like they did the Valve approach. They took the pieces of the engine that they wanted to tune up, separated them out, assigned teams to them and said, okay, you guys rework the animation system. You guys rework the texture system. You guys rework the mapping system. And the result is that they have essentially a new engine, but it's built on the framework of the old engine, mm-hmm. but it's way more sophisticated. But then at the same time, that means the presentation included, look at this bolt in the piece of woodwork. Like, really? Yeah. Really?
I think one of the things that I think to also take as a takeaway is like this whole armor upgrade permutation system is going to really customize the way you kind of load out your character and the way you play, both in single player and multiplayer, and showing a sprint for the first time got me excited because that's one of the things over the years of playing Halo I've just gotten tired of is that slow, plodding, methodical movement as Master Chief.
Well, that's just one of the reusable equipment. Exactly. I like the idea of equipment being reusable, though.
Yeah, and the way they had, at least the sprint was the only one they're showing currently. You know, it has this little circle that runs down as you're sprinting. But the cool thing is that, or the, actually the interesting thing, in the beta when it launches, they actually won't be including all the upgrades in the beta. They are basically going to be.
I thought he said they were.
No, when I asked him, they said they weren't. But I specifically asked if they were. But what they're going to do is they're going to include all the ones they think are most likely to need tweaking, and they're going to save some back after the fact.
That would qualify under the Brian statement of it'll be a nice cross section,
yes.
Nice cross section representation of the final Halo Reach experience.
That is exactly it. I will say though, when they pulled out the kind of the new BR, the single shot BR, when they shot it. The sound system they had playing, it's like that new sound effect. And like
the marksman rifle.
Yeah.
The marksman rifle is really cool. Yeah. The marksman rifle looked like a tool that I would definitely be enjoying putting use. The needler rifle was neat.
Yeah.
But the marksman rifle, I was like, okay, that's me. Mid totally. To long range. Lots of move, shoot. You know, it's sort of a almost Tom Clancy-like sort of approach to it because you're looking for cover and finding your shot.
I can't wait till May 3rd because, I like games. I like playing them. And I am really worried.
My name is David Ellis, and I like games.
I think I would expect, though, man, that I don't think I would expect anyone to be able to play that first day because I think the amount of numbers that they're going to have, I think we're going to have a replay of, like, the Halo 3 beta with Crackdown disc all over again where just no one can get it for like the first day or so because they're just going to get slammed. You have to imagine the amount of data that's going to be pumped. It's going to be sick.
I'm sure they'll do their best to be equipped and ready for it, and I'm sure that demand will will drive them crazy and that they'll be in a tough spot and they'll do the best they can with it. I mean, you think it's going to be any different for the StarCraft 2 beta?
Oh, good God, yeah. And Battle.net's, I mean, had its own issues. They're just trying to upgrade to like build that infrastructure to kind of build that up. So, yeah, I guess we'll see soon enough, and we're hoping maybe StarCraft Beta will be hitting next week.
So it's hard for me to say anything else about Reach because it looks really pretty.
Yeah, so for the people that weren't there, they showed us the vid doc, they showed us a slide deck, and then they actually loaded up the internal alpha that they're using currently basically on a multiplayer map called Powerhouse and then ran around, shot some weapons, threw some grenades, stuff like that. Pretty basic, but yeah, you got a sense of like the new sound effects and stuff like that. But it would have been nice to see like at least a snippet of a campaign thing. But I suspect as we get closer to E3, we'll be seeing way more of the campaign.
Absolutely.
So, well, that was Halo 3. The other game that I wanted to talk about, and I actually was fortunate enough to have some of the guys working on Crackdown 2 here in the studio earlier today and got a chance to record actually about a 40-minute chat with them about the
Wait.
I know it's your nap time. You are getting older, and you do have to take your mid-afternoon siestas.
Well, if you bring me Nilla wafers and some high C, we'll make this happen.
I want to throw it to that for 40 minutes. Take a break. Enjoy yourself. And then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about Crackdown 2 and then all the other games we saw there at X10, and then we'll wrap it up. And this is a special Friday morning hangover / voices are gone podcast. It's the day after X10. Hours and hours of demos and interviews. And I'm joined here in studio by three of the gentlemen behind Ruffian Games' upcoming Crackdown 2. With me in studio is Peter Connolly, executive producer of Microsoft Game Studios, James Cope, producer at Ruffian, and John Noonan, lead developer and test at Microsoft Game Studios. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. You guys are going to have to carry this conversation because my voice is completely shot.
And nobody said anything about carrying anything.
We didn't talk at all yesterday. We're fine.
Oh, my God, yeah. So when did you guys get in town for X10? Because talking to everyone yesterday, it was like some people got in the day before, some people got in the morning of, some people were just like last second rushing from the airport to get over to the event.
Yeah, we were pretty hot. I mean, we came in sort of the day before, late afternoon. John was here pretty early. So he was
John. John does the actual work.
Yeah,
so he actually got here.
I went over there just to make sure that we weren't running in standard def on a 20-year-old CRT.
It does happen.
It was an awesome setup though. They did a good job, I think.
Yeah, I thought the setup was nice.
The video setup was really good.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, it seemed like you were keeping really busy all day, and like the section you guys were in, it was like constantly full. People kind of coming in and out, checking out the demo. What did you find to be the reaction from people there? I mean, you never really know when you're showing stuff up until you're really chatting afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, speaking for myself, I mean, I definitely liked what I saw. And Jeremy Parrish, who wrote their preview for us at 1UP, you know, seemed to enjoy it quite a bit as well. It was, I don't know, it was just cool seeing it. Last year, TGS was like a pleasant surprise. We weren't expecting what we got at all. And so now seeing like some of the single player stuff and vehicles, like, you know, looks quite different than it did even just a few months ago.
I think we had a good plan going in. You know, the game has come on an awful lot, and I think Ruffian have busted ass to bring us the fidelity we have now. I think we just wanted to show off that, you know, and get that out there to people. I think John made the point yesterday several times about getting people to understand the mission structure and the campaign, what they're actually going to do in the game, the user flow through the game a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is in a show like this is, you know, you've got like rotations of 20 or 30 minutes and the game is hours and hours of gameplay.
Right.
And you're trying, okay, how do we get them to all the, you know, the stuff that we're going to produce and provide them with. But I think the reaction overall was really, really good. I'm really happy. The game looks and the show is awesome now, and we've got so much fun in it that we can point to and bring people moments to, and they just, oh, wow, you can do that. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, one of the first things when I walked over, like first thing in the morning, I saw you guys flying around with a helicopter with, you know, agents hanging off the side of it and shooting people and all that stuff. Adding kind of, you know, aircraft element to it, was that a challenge for you guys? Like, or was it pretty fairly easy in the scheme of things to implement?
It was an interesting one because, you know, I mean, the game is about kind of vertical exploration in a massive sense. So we were a little bit concerned about it being a bit of a game breaker, mm-hmm. you know. So we had to think about it really carefully. But, you know, the other side of that was that, well, it is the ultimate agility tool, you know, and the ability to glide and the ability to fly mm-hmm. is like kind of, well, that's as far as you can go with the kind of verticality thing. And so we definitely wanted to explore it. And then we thought, like, well, actually, we can do it as a player award. You know, it's about making sure that, you know, we have the game structured so that that is your ultimate reward for collecting agility orbs and things like that.
Right,
and
so this isn't something you're going to be getting early in the game at all.
No, I mean, it's something you'll be seeing. I mean, like helicopters play an important role in kind of the mission structure. They handle airdrops and things like that. So you'll be seeing them right from the beginning. They'll be around you, and it's a nice little aspirational thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'll see these helicopters dropping equipment down to you, and you'll be thinking, like, oh, I want to fly that. So, you know, if you play well, you can commandeer a helicopter for a bit, you know, and stuff like that. But ultimately, it's, you know, one of the vehicles you get rewarded with for doing all of your skill progression. So
I mean, going back to kind of the transition from you know, real time worlds with the first game to Ruffian, what was the process like for those of you that made the transition? I mean, that had to be kind of a tough decision to make. I know there was a lot of people that were passionate about Crackdown and wanted to continue making it, but, you know, going to work and saying, oh yeah, we're starting a new studio a couple miles down the road.
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, you know, I think the hardest part of it was that, you know, we retain a really great friendship with people that are still there. And, you know, the entire the original Crackdown team was, you know, probably the tightest team feel that we ever had and mm-hmm. I've ever had in any kind of work. And that was great. You know, it's a great feeling that we all had this kind of sense of belonging with Crackdown. So it's hard to go through that process of, you know, not having the sequel and things like that. So
yeah,
when it came to like the whole Ruffian thing becoming, you know, an opportunity for people, it was like, you know, kind of this feeling of getting the band back together a little bit. And you know, then a natural side effect of that was that it was hard for the people that wanted to stay over real time or just weren't available, things mm-hmm. like that, you know. So there was a little bit of that going on. But, you know, overall, the big thing for us is that when we set up Ruffian was that, you know, it wasn't particularly about Crackdown. It was about a real strong desire to make really, really good core action games. And that's what we wanted to do regardless of whatever franchise we ended up working on. And that was something that, you know, going back to like kind of the pre-history of Ruffian, when some of us are working as a kind of contract services company as part of Zen,
mm-hmm.
that was ultimately what we wanted to try and do. You know, it's every developer's dream, you know, set up your own studio and work on really, really great AAA titles and really core action games. And, you know, so it was a great feeling to be able to actually get that. It was an achievement. But, you know, the downward slope of that was really the kind of settling realization that we had an absolute sod of a year to go through. And, mm. and we had a massive mountain to climb. But from day one, it was like, you know, the team was back to... I know, but it was like... I'm not going to get into the moany timescale thing, but, you know, it was a hard thing. And we're just lucky that we had a very, very fast ability to get the team running really quickly. And that sense of kind of like camaraderie between all of that was really powerful. Yeah. And I think that's the only way we've really ended up with Crackdown 2 in the way it is now.
So. One of the questions I get from a lot of people is just, it's probably one you guys get all the time. It's kind of, you know, what percentage of the team from the first Crackdown made the move over to Ruffian?
It's a difficult question. I honestly can't work it out because, the development team's a little bit transient anyway. And, we've put, like, I guess, at least half of the team. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's like half of Ruffian. So, right. You know, we're about 49 people, and that's the Ruffian studio. And, you know, about 20 people from there were Crackdown veterans. So, you know, that was like the core part of the game anyway. So we don't really think about it.
Half of those are from Zen as well.
So. Yeah, exactly. And then the other half was from Zen and things like that. And then we've got guys that have been contracted out to Microsoft for a long time, you know, working on games like Fable 2 and PGR. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of like prehistory to it. And it's nice, you know, we've got a really, really good pool of talent. And, you know, it's great to be able to say that I'm honestly working with some of the most talented people I've ever had the privilege to work with.
And, thanks, James.
And so, it's down to them. They're just, you know, I've said this before. Some of the guys that we have just scare the crap out of me. They're just like kind of, I don't know, magicians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, by the time Crackdown releases, it will be, you know, over 3 years, if I'm doing my math correctly, 3 years since the release of the original. In the interim, there's been actually a pretty substantial growth in kind of the open world action game genre. You had Infamous last year. It's a slightly different take on it. Was Red Faction, Guerrilla, and of course Prototype. What are some things that you guys, I mean, you have to balance of making it feel like Crackdown, but also doing things new with it. What was the challenge in actually creating something that took and learned, but still retained faithful to the original?
I mean, I think we've really carved out our own niche in that, you know, we've got co-op in a way that no other open world action game has, and it, you know, it's four players and it's jump in, jump out, and I mean that's a huge technical challenge, and so we feel like we've got something unique. I mean, we love all those other open world action games and we're fans of the genre, and we play them all, but we think that, you know, Crackdown retains something that's pretty unique. And there's also just sort of a tongue-in-cheek sort of sense of the world that we don't take ourselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. Some of the best Crackdown moments are you're walking down the street and some character's walking, you know, across the street and just gets hit by a bus, and you know that's funny and we love that stuff. And so I mean, I think that at the end of the day, you know, we've got something
slight
that's different.
Insight into John's mind. You know, just don't walk too close to the curb.
Well, or you know, the other one is you cause some giant explosion and, you know, some car lifts up into the atmosphere and you're walking down the street and, you know, it lands on your co-op buddy just completely out of nowhere. It's almost slapstick. But yeah, it's unique and we feel like we've got, you know, a little bit of a different story to tell.
Well, could you mention story? Because that was going to be where I wanted to go next. I mean, the first game was pretty bare bones in story and, you know, it's both a blessing and a curse. You don't have to worry about story, like a convoluted plot and cheesy dialogue getting in the way of kind of just having fun with the game. But there are also a lot of people that kind of want to know more about the world and actually have a little bit of exposition so that their actions have greater meaning and context. Mm-hmm. Are there going to be more in-game cinemas, more of a story this time around?
I don't know that you have to have in-game cinemas and interruptions mm-hmm. to people's gameplay to do that. But I mean, the question is valid. Like, did we have a story last time? Yeah. We say we did, but we just didn't tell it. And so this time I think we want to give the facility to the player to explore that. And I think we are doing that. You know, we've got different elements in the game that allow people to interact with the story when they want to. I think one of the things that John touched on there is Ruffian will always attest to, the gameplay always comes first with Crackdown. So when you were talking about freeform moments that happen, and early on you were talking about why would you put air vehicles into the game? It's because of the gameplay. You know, it's because, well, you can, and therefore you should. And if it breaks a bit of the gameplay and it breaks a bit of this and that, so be it. If the player's got it, they deserve it. And story is part of that too. We didn't do that service to people who want to explore and get context around the game they're playing. We didn't provide that last time. We got slightly slapped for it, and we recognize that. And I think this time we have more in that line. But Crackdown's never going to be a story game. Mm. We just want to give people the facility to explore the story. So we put it in. You know, I think there's good stuff in there. The guys might want to elaborate more. But
I think another thing to say about that is that, you know, we created something kind of accidentally that was kind of synonymous with Crackdown. I mean, the agency and the voice of the agency. And,
yeah.
And a lot of people often wonder, you know, well, who was that, you know? And, you know, it's great to be able to actually think in Crackdown 2 about, you know, learning more about who that guy is and where it's going and the motives behind the agency and things like that. So there's a lot of kind of like subtext and background plot. And we have a fairly complete story arc. But, you know, what we try and do is try and pull little key elements out of that mm-hmm. and let the player kind of like assemble that in their mind and at their will. It's a lot like the way the game works. You know, we don't try and force people down a particular linear path of gameplay. We want them to experiment and use their own creativity to figure out what to do. And in the same way, you know, that action carries across into the way we're trying to set up this kind of context of the world and what's going on. You know, so they can pull bits and pieces out and eventually unfold this like kind of I know what it's about now. You know,
yeah.
Cinematics is an interesting one because we don't want to have that interrupted gameplay mm-hmm. thing. I mean, I think it's pretty true. All of us here, when we play Crackdown, it was basically cinematic skip, 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 skip.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, I got caught out by this. This is an interesting story.
That's right, sure.
A few of us on the dev team we actually forgot that we renamed the islands.
Actually, hang on, ask John.
So, here's an interesting thing, right? So, Shai Gen, for example, is now Unity Heights in Crackdown 2.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've renamed all the islands and. And I actually thought that, you know, where did that come from? John, can you remember?
I have no idea where it came from. where did the renaming come from?
So
it's
actually,
from the agency, but...
It was actually in Crackdown 1.
At the very end.
No. It's every time you beat a gang, the cinematic would say, well done, agent. Your actions have led to the renaming of Los Muertos to Green Bay.
I know.
And nobody knows this.
Skip. No idea.
Because everyone skipped the cinematics. So, you know, even though that Crackdown 1 had those little intros and outros,
yeah.
it just didn't really add anything to the game. No one paid any attention. So we kind of thought, well why even bother, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of investment of time and
actually frustrating
and
people too.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So it's just like, well, okay, we'll just do away with them completely, you know? So everything that we have to do now about explaining what's happened with game direction and all that kind of thing has to be kind of incidental in the world and down to the player to explore. And that's actually much more effective because... they'll pay more attention to it, you know. That's the way we kind of go with it.
When you talk to players who played Crackdown 1, it's really like a 50-50 split. There's like half the people are like, oh, I love that there wasn't much story there. And half of them are like, oh, I wish there was more story. And
yeah.
So that's like a really big challenge for a team. And if you put cinematics in the middle of it, you know, you're only appeasing half of those people. So I think that with Crackdown 2, I mean, there's a lot of the story is kind of opt-in. You know, if you want to dig deeper, if you want to learn more about it, it's there for you, but we're never going to force it down your throat.
One of the things I found with the people I've talked to about the original Crackdown, the people's opinions on the story and how much there was and whether they wanted more was almost always correlated directly to how much co-op they played.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because when you're playing with another person, it's like it Crackdown that experience. And I talking to you last night a little bit about it is it's very much this kind of it's this lobby where you can get together and just talk and just hang out. But in the middle of it, you can just fuck around and have a ton of fun just trying to experiment with the world.
Yeah.
And so the more I found I would play that, is the less I would pay attention to the story because, you know, me and the other person I was playing with, we were making our own story as we went along because the real story, there's not multiple agents running around, but now there are.
Yeah.
So adding like four player into that will – if someone's, for example, since you can kind of drop in, drop out at the same time, will someone else's experiences, if they drop into someone's world who hasn't explored much around the island, how will that affect kind of the experience of the person who's just starting out? Will they be able to give them like crazy weapons that you wouldn't necessarily have access to?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the beauties of Crackdown is that, you know, with the co-op experience, we don't think about kind of channeling gameplay in any way. So a couple of aspects there is that we have this belief where co-op naturally makes the game easier for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things with Crackdown is that achievements is a good example of this in that, you know, some of the achievements were really hard to get. So you just brought in a co-op buddy and suddenly it became easier. So, you know, we don't try and balance the game like that. And again, you know, if you're coming into a world where you've got, a level 5 agent versus a level 1 agent and they're giving them weapons to play with, then great. You know, that is the game. You know, it's about using that ability to exploit the game as much as the way we want to try and deliver the mechanism. I mean, it's like some people would worry about like breaking the game experience, but to us it's just that is the game. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's about trying to exploit the game in a way, you know, and it's about trying to do that thing out of order. And that's all of that that's the player creativity, and you know, that's what we try and do. And
you set up a bunch of toys and then you let people play with them. It's not up to us to dictate how they play with them.
Yeah. So you mentioned level one, level five agents. Are you playing the same agent this time around, or have you guys talked about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, you know, for us it goes back to sort of fairly core experience, and and one of the great things about Crackdown was that you became this superhero, and you weren't that, you know, it's not something we give you at the beginning. And because you have that ownership of that empowerment, you invested the time and you got the reward. That's why you felt powerful, you know. And so we wanted to go through that experience again. You know, we could have said, okay, play as level five. But, you know, there's new things in Crackdown 2 that we want even veteran players to be able to come back to it and have that feeling again. You know, it is a great feeling to go through that kind of investment and become that superhero. So, you know, that was really important to us. And you know... Interestingly, you know, a good point here. We talk about level five agent. We always had this problem on Crackdown that, you know, you start off as a zero star agent and it was a one star agent and go up to a four star, and it's just like, oh, it's so confusing. So right. We've kind of reset it all a little bit and said, okay, it's easy. It's level one to five, and you know, that's straightforward. So we've kind of tidied up the kind of progression, made it a little bit easier, addressed the balance of things. Because one of the other points there is that, yeah, you know, I think the people that got the most out of Crackdown are the people that invested most time. You invest this kind of like 6 or 7 hours in the game, and all of a sudden it just kind of completely takes off, and you're this like super thing that is just amazing, you can do anything. The people that didn't really get that far into the game, they just didn't get it. And so, you know, we wanted to try and address that balance of kind of investment versus reward. And so hopefully, you know, even though that we're kind of resetting players, they'll be getting back into that really super experience again pretty quickly, and you know, going through that whole empowerment process and that feeling of like being a god within the world, and you know, that's what we wanted to do.
Well, with some of the abilities with the first game, you would get to a point where you're pretty high level in some things, but not necessarily in the other, and you'd find that you'd almost have to grind very much like an MMO just to level it up, whether it's driving or explosives or whatever, because, you know, the leveling was based on how you played the game. But, you know, everyone that plays games, or almost everyone that plays games, are completionists. They want to level up everything and be as powerful as they possibly can. How have you guys kind of streamlined the kind of leveling system this time around so as to, you know, do you guys want to limit the grinding, or do you actually think that worked in the first game?
That's interesting. I mean, some of it worked and some of it didn't. I mean, you mentioned driving there, and that clearly didn't. You know, great shame for us was that the best things in the game came with, like, the level 5 SUV. You know, it was a thing that could go anywhere, drive up walls. It had, you know, the ability to jump on demand and things like that. And I think pretty much, I can't remember the numbers, but it was like sort of only it's like 30% of players ever saw that, you know. So that was really bad, and driving generally was hard.
And I talked to a lot of people. It's like, yeah, you know, you don't in this game we're going to make it so you don't necessarily have to go find like a jump and just, you know, do backflips for an hour to get your driving up. And a bunch of people are like, oh, that's exactly what I did in the first game. I was like, well, that's great that you did it, but a lot of people didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, particularly for driving, I mean, you get experience now for handbrake turns. You get, you know, there's, you know, at night there's freaks just wandering the world and you
just
know,
run
it's
them over.
Great lawnmower fun to just go smashing through a couple hundred freaks. And so we think that there's, you know, a lot more ways to level up your driving this time. And also I think just sort of giving people more obvious incentive at the outset. You know, we never really told people, hey, if you level up your driving skill to 5, you're going to get a jumping SUV that drives up walls.
Yeah.
So, you know, providing, I think, a little bit more of a carrot for people will help in that regard too.
So will there be kind of a player progression graph that you'll be able to see in the game to be able to
in Excel, yeah, it'll be there.
I guess graph's the wrong word. Yeah. So
if you guys
use our restroom facilities, you'll see that someone at some point decided to take Sins of a Solar Empire and take the entire tech tree and tape it up on one of the stalls so that there's always plenty of reading material when you're in there. So, but there is kind of a tech tree, you know, that's the wrong word, but skill tree in Crackdown 2, whether it's the vehicles and, you know, abilities. Will you be able to see that in the game? Or will it be kind of a behind the scenes, you don't really know it until you get it?
Well, we want to make it very obvious. I mean, you know, we talk about kind of progression and reward. And, you know, it's going to be very simple. You start off with actually some really good cars and vehicles and things like that. You start off now with the best sports car, the agency sports car, and that's just fast. You can do anything that you want. Scoops vehicles out of the way. It's great fun. You know, it's the thing that people remember about the sports car from Crackdown. Mm-hmm. Straight away you get that. So it's like, you know, okay, I've got this really cool thing. I understand what's going on. And then as soon as you level up your driving, it's like, you know, here's another vehicle. And, you know, it kind of, it's much more direct. It's much more rewarding. It's like every time you invest that time.
Luckily, a new toy for people to progress rather than making the same toy with a different skin. Yeah.
And so I'm assuming, you know, the first crack, you know, whether it was playing co-op by yourself, people are really smart and were able to figure out shortcuts of doing things they shouldn't be able to do.
Good for them.
Yeah, exactly. Is that something you guys are still supporting? Because I saw the new agency tower, at least. I assume that's what it was because I didn't actually get to sit through the little demo. But it's a huge fucking building in the middle of the area.
That's Hope Tower.
So my question is, first thing I thought when at TGS when I saw the, you know, I can't remember the name of the great grenade, the one.
The mag grenade.
Mag grenade. I saw that. The first thing I thought is I want to stick mag grenade onto my a buddy of mine and just shoot him up there. Is that possible at this point? Or have you guys messed around with – how does the mag grenade interact with characters, like humans?
We're still messing around with it. I mean, you know, we do have to be careful. We talk about this as it's interestingly because some of our best features came out of bugs originally in Crackdown. And you know
– What are some of those?
Yeah. Talk about sharing the underwear.
Well, the sticky SUVs. The SUV that drove up walls. That was literally a bug from the first game, but it was an awesome bug. So it's like, hey, we should keep this. We should, you know. I think we ended up putting a couple of little limitations in it so it wouldn't completely break the experience. But yeah,
that's exactly it. I mean, it's like, you know, we're still in that process of trying to figure out exploit versus fun, and mag grenades are just they're so abstract. We can't even think about the way that they're going to break things. So we keep finding little things where we think, no, we can't do that. The range of them is no good. A good one we had recently was like with the wingsuit and jump pads. You know,
have you seen the jump pads, Dave?
They're in PvP. TGS.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about that is that because they propel you horizontally so fast that we actually had this bug where you could activate the wingsuit whilst you were in the jump pad, and you could fly it like almost, you know, 600 miles an hour around the world. You know? And it was just like, yeah, we better fix that one because, you know, you could turn.
One of my favorite moments when we were playing PvP and using the jump pads is I was watching a friend of mine, Patrick Klepek from G4. He jumped and he had his back turned. All of a sudden he stops and he doesn't realize what's happening. He turns around and him and someone else had hit opposite jump pads and hit each other midair. And he was smart enough to actually shoot first and took the guy out with one shot in midair with the shotgun. And when it happened, it's like that's the key. Like, that's those kind of moments are for me what I enjoyed the most about Crackdown 1. So getting back to the vehicles real quick, you guys aren't morphing the vehicles as you kind of level them up now. The effect of the morphing was cool, but possibly why take that kind of out?
It really was a matter of kind of bang for buck. I mean, it's very simple. We wanted to kind of redress the balance with making sure that people got the best features out of the vehicles at the right time. So we talk about having the fastest ability sports car right early on. It's about giving people that kind of great experience. And, you know, we wanted to try and think about more about how we reward the player with different types of vehicles. And this whole thing kind of wraps around into many different issues. The more we think about it, you know, the more we feel that we are making the right decision here, because couple of things going on with Crackdown was going back to the agency garage. You had to go all the way back to the agency garage, get your vehicle out, watch it transform, go, ooh, that's nice. Drive it out the agency tunnel. By the time you've got out the tunnel, it's half destroyed. And, you know, where you wanted to actually take the car, it just didn't really work. So it was a nice little feature, but it was very costly. You know, and we wanted to put more vehicles in the game. We wanted to put more agency equipment in the game. And the more we thought about this whole thing of having everything have this ability to morph and transform, it was just going to cost too much. And the gameplay reward for that was just not high enough. So we thought, okay, difficult decision, but let's go without it and make sure we get more vehicles, more gameplay out, and sort of more rewarding progression experience for the player. So, you know, it's rather than having like five different levels of agency car now where there's very indistinguishable difference between driving at 100 miles an hour and 120 miles an hour and just progressing between those two things. It's more about saying, like, okay, here's a really fast car, here's a helicopter, here's a tank, here's a buggy. These are very contrasty things and much more rewarding in gameplay.
You mentioned transforming and morphing, and we finally got a chance to see kind of the kind of destructed nature of the environment of, you know, Crackdown now, and you're in the same areas from the first game. How do you balance being in the same spot and wanting it to be true to it, but also provide areas and environments where you still feel like you're finding things new as you're playing the game?
That's a good one. I mean, we touched on this earlier with like trying to tell a story with a game. I mean, we have this problem with Crackdown is that we never had an identifiable player character. You know, it was just this mindless clone. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point of the agents. They are mindless clones. And so you can't really have them doing any dialogue or narrative. There's no story to tell with agents. There's more of a story to tell with the world you're playing in, and there's more of a story to tell with the voice of the agency and things like that. So we wanted to really kind of experiment with where we're telling the kind of progression of the world. We wanted to instill that sense of familiarity, sense of deja vu, and get players to think about, well, I remember this city, it was nice and, you know, it was lovely, I rescued this city, and now it's all gone to shit, and what's happened to it, and all these new things that have appeared, and all this decay that's gone on, and all of these things kind of like just give this sense of a story context.
Yeah, I think the balance, like if you look yesterday where John was bringing people over to excuse me, Wang's Tower, when it was, you know, it's at the top of it.
Did you ahem to say Wang?
I ahem to get the hangover out of my throat. Yeah. And then right beside it, you see Hope Tower, you know, and I think for me, the answer is the balance is in making sure that we provide this time around the same 3D, excellent 3D platformer that we did the first time, but maintain the fact that you walk in the city and you go, it's familiar, but it's new. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of got that sense of, well, I know this place, but what is this massive building that I now have to get to climb?
Right.
And, you know, collect all orbs along the way up. And, get gameplay moments on the way up and the way back down as well, as John showed. So I think that's the balance for me, is making sure that I always use the phrase that you know that you remember the roads and you remember the road layout, but all the buildings are new or destroyed, you know, and so there's a whole new platform to jump around.
Well, ledges are different. Yeah. I mean, there's whole new districts in some areas. I mean,
that's right. Sure.
The other challenge is, I mean, we have, you know, PvP in this game, so there's areas in the world which are, you know, we've set up for PvP. And, you know, that's a whole different set of challenges. And it's an open world game. So it's like, well, this area has to work for, you know, open world normal campaign, but also has to work for PvP. So even in the places that are destructed, there's actually a lot of care that's gone into, you know, making sure that, you know, they're destructed in a way that there's, you know, cool platforms and that, you know, the distances between jumps works. And so
town planning at a high level.
It's like, yeah, planning how to destroy something is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting from us from a production point of view, because, you know, it was a lot of effort. You know, it's as much effort as creating a new city. So it's interesting. And you know, I think it's interesting for us as well, because I mean, philosophically, we're kind of like all neophiliacs in gaming.
That's a big word.
It's like I don't know what it means.
Is he undressing?
We're obsessed with new things.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like we waste a lot. We waste a lot in video games. It's like we're always creating new stuff. And it's like, well, why don't we kind of revisit some of the stuff from the past and kind of bring that back to life and try and tell stories with that, you know? So I kind of like that kind of sense of familiarity and revisiting old places. And
it's awesome to go to like Funland in what's, you know, Green Bay now. And you go over and everyone remembers that area. That's really where you started in the first game. But man, look at you know, the Ferris wheels ripped to shreds and the clown face is all sort of deformed. And so, I mean, people absolutely remember those areas, but it's like, wow, look, I mean, it really does seem like a lot has happened here.
Gives us the chance to place things as well. Like, I mean, orbs are, you know, Gareth and those guys back in Ruffian have been doing an awesome job of stuffing. What did I say to some journalist last night? Oh, check your shoes, yeah.
Yeah, if you hidden orbs like really hard, look at your shoes.
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, the guys back at Ruff, just to be quite frank about it, are busting ass right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to give one thing. It's nice for us to sit here and be chatting away, but they're sitting there in their offices at midnight and beyond, coding up a storm and, you know, making things look pretty and sound great and play great. But so yeah, they're stuffing orbs into places that we can now. You know,
yeah,
oh, yeah. I have this thing with Gareth. God damn it, man! They're never going to get that. Yes, they will.
I mean, one of the things seeing the game, like the first game had this kind of interesting cell shading that wasn't overt, but it was kind of subtle, but you noticed it. And seeing the game yesterday, it looked like it still had it, but then the screenshots that were released, don't look like they have the cell shading.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are just curious.
Screenshots lie.
Yeah. I mean, okay, right. Let's try and redress the balance a little bit. We never claim we're cell shaded.
Right. So, I guess the border, there's like a dark border versus the traditional
Absolutely.
Cell shading.
I mean, what we always wanted to try and do is trying to look like a bit of a graphic novel in motion sort of thing. And that, the whole outlining thing and stuff like that is trying to move towards that. And we think with Crackdown 2, we've gone even closer to that. There's a really boring technical reason why the screenshots don't lose some of that kind of like outline fidelity and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's something that we believe in. We want to have that kind of fluid comic book feel. And, you know, Crackdown is about kind of really nice, contrasting, vibrant colors. It's rich color palettes and things like that. Not necessarily, you know, We fight about it. We laugh about Crackdown. I remember the purple build we got. You know, we demoed somewhere and the game was almost entirely purple. And it was like, oh my god!
It was Amsterdam, I think.
Yeah.
Build. Yeah. We talk about, you know, every game has its thing that it needs to get over, both internally and externally. And in the first game, it was the purple problem. I guess I haven't really. Yeah. Figure out what it is this time.
But, we're going back to it, you know, we said, like, we must avoid the purple problem, you know, and we ended up with a brown problem instead.
So many games, and especially in this generation, we've got all this power to make, you know, uber realism. So
right.
There's so many, you know, everyone's mastered the browns and grays, you know, that color palette has been well explored, I think, on the current generation. So, you know, I think it's an opportunity for us to really punch up the colors and, you know, we've got these super vibrant sunsets and super vibrant colors. And is it realistic? No, but you know, it's a video game. It's, you know, we can play with realism and go above and beyond it.
To your point though, about the screenshots and the shots that have been released, Crackdown's always been one of those games that suffered from the still image issue. Mm. You know, I mean, it's a game, you know, games are in motion.
Mm-hmm.
They're not PowerPoint slides or, well, they're not meant to be anyway. Sometimes.
It's that EP with a gripe.
As I look at Ruffian. Now, it's meant to run at 30 hertz. It will.
It's meant to run at 60, so there.
I'll take 30. So the still image issue, I think that, you know, we suffer from that a little bit too. I mean, correct. You saw it yesterday, you know.
Yeah.
And when you see it in motion, it's beautiful and it's looking really, really good. I can't comment on the actual screenshots you've been given. I don't know what the actual
status of that is. I mean, the ones that came out in the press pack, I mean, there's some really good ones in there. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of trying to focus on some of the new abilities, vehicles, and things like that. And
they're good shots, but it's just like some people are just curious because it seems like the outline's less pronounced.
I mean, if you really want to know, we take high-res screenshots to be able to use in print media.
Yeah.
And the way the tech works is that the outlines don't actually increase in depth. So it's the same, you increase the resolution, but the actual outline text stays the same width. So when it's shrunk back down to screen resolution, you've lost a lot of that outlining. So
that makes sense.
It's a really simple problem, but actually one that, you know, we've always fought against in Crackdown. It's like we've always had this problem of making sure that our screenshots reflect what the game's like. And
we
it's
don't
true.
Want to be going into Photoshop and doctrine them to.
Sure.
You know, the engine takes the shot and that's it. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like, Bungie released their first ring of screenshots for Reach. There was a glitch in the game where the targeting reticule, when they took screenshots, showed up like 6 inches to the left of where it was supposed to.
Yeah.
And there was nothing they could do. And they weren't going to doctor it, so they put it out there. And of course, Bungie fans are so hardcore that they assumed it was some new weapon, new tech.
I think that's part of the reason that people weren't allowed to record yesterday. We had some debug text on screen and people, you know,
read too much into that stuff.
Yeah. But isn't it great though? I think that's great. I mean, good for them, good for us that we're in an industry that people give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and people look at that and go, oh, look, they must be adding the new Supermoon function. Have you heard about that? And people go out and they make all sorts of, John and his team would come to me regularly in the last game with stories about what people were saying out there. Is this really going to happen? I'm like, I don't think so.
Someone, I know a little bit about it because I read some of the preview coverage. Someone asked if you guys could elaborate a little bit on Project Sunburst and how it relates to the game.
Sure. I mean, Project Sunburst is like the primary objective.
Don't tell them about Sunburst.
We're not allowed to talk about Project Sunburst. No, so no, we are. It was actually interesting. We tried to tease with it in TGS. We had this big banner at the bottom of the splash screen saying "Don't talk about Project Sunburst," and disappointed that no one picked up on that. But anyway,
I think we were so surprised that the game was playable. You could film it and everything. It was like that blew me away. It was like the highlight of TGS for me, and like I think everyone else that was there to play it.
It really is like it's just the assembly of a massive weapon. So, you know, ultimate objective in Crackdown 2, save Pacific City, destroy the freaks. It's that simple, you know. So the way we do that is Project Sunburst. It's a collection of UV energy. Freaks are sensitive to UV light. And so we have these things called absorption units that are scattered around the world. And you're effectively connecting up this network of energy where it's being moved around and beamed across the sky into things called beacons. And beacons are basically just energy bombs that you drop into freak lair. Which we've not shown yet, but you know that's basically the mechanic of connecting this big web of energy, and focus it all into places to create bombs, setting them off, destroying freaks, and going through the locations like that. And ultimately, it all culminates in the ultimate beacon, which will destroy all freaks in the world once and for all. So that is Project Sunburst, and the great thing about it is that you know it's fairly simple in its mechanics, but it allows us to play with variety and strategy and all that kind of thing that we felt was missing from Crackdown. You know, it's like rather than having the same mission 21 times, it's this ultimate objective that's very clear to explain to the player. They find all of these bits and pieces of it, and you know it's down to them how they plug it all together and what order they do that in. So, you know, I'm really pleased with it. It's a nice little mechanic. It tells a story and it's very simple to the player to understand. It's blowing things up. You know, it's cool.
Well, yesterday, and we talked a little bit of this at the event, but I wanted to go ahead and get it on the record so people kind of know.
I'll deny it.
Aaron Greenberg and the Microsoft guys, they made a little bit of a mistake, typo.
Oh, here we go.
Listing
you will deny it.
Listing, I will deny it. I'll deny it now. You don't have to continue.
Listing Crackdown 2 as a June release, which is roughly the time frame that initially I think was out there, but that has changed and that information is no longer correct. What can you tell us about when we'll be playing Crackdown 2?
I can absolutely guarantee that you will play Crackdown 2 this year. That's as much as I can guarantee.
what about a demo?
And you will definitely play a demo this year.
How much earlier will you be able to have the demo before you play the game? Will it be similar to the first game?
Yeah, it will. It definitely. You know, we had a clear plan to, and I always have had a clear plan with John's team's blessing that we would get our demo out there and certified. You know, some in the delta being 3 to 4 weeks before the retail game hits, and that still holds true. Mm-hmm. But how we tee that up now, things have changed a little bit, and we're not in a position just right because things have changed a little bit. You're going to get the game this year for sure,
right?
But how we tee it up is being massaged right now based on a lot of different influences.
And a lot of times that's probably not up to the team that's making the game. Marketing gets involved.
Yeah, there's a lot of parameters. I mean, it's a business, not a charity. Sure. But we have a couple of things to look after. We have to look after the interests of the game. And the platform we play this game on is we couldn't do this game without the platform we're on. That's
you're not
sure.
Delaying it to add Natal into Crackdown 2, are you?
We're not delaying it to add Natal into Crackdown. No. We're not. We're just not in a position right now to talk about how we roll it out. But suffice to say that you will get your demo, and you will get the demo in a time frame to whet your appetite to get the retail thing. And you'll play both this year for sure. I think pretty soon you'll find out. We'll definitely let you know.
Yeah.
ASAP.
I think it's worth clarifying that the difference between the press release in the morning yesterday and whatever was sent out, an hour later or whatever, was not a delay, but just really a typo in a press release.
Yeah, exactly.
We had someone came to us and we accidentally wrote something in this press release this morning. It's like, you did what? So it's not really a delay. It's just like, that's not the plan.
Yeah.
Just a mistake.
And I'm pretty sure this case, Crackdown 2, you will be able to install it on your hard drive. I mean, the original Crackdown was patched, so you could.
Yeah.
Someone asked me about that. So
No, that's cool. I mean,
kudos to this guy. They're the ones who sweated it out to give that to people.
It was a nightmare. So.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there's nothing scarier than updating like a 3-year-old game.
Yeah.
And something that's as complicated as Crackdown is. I mean, the streaming engine, we think, is pretty unrivaled, across the industry. And going in and tweaking that so that it could run off of the hard drive. And, you know, when we shipped Crackdown, we had no idea that you'd be able to install the hard drive 3 years later.
Yeah.
So, we had some trepidation about going back and doing it, but, it turned out well. And, I love having Crackdown on my Xbox. It's like, oh, hey, look, there it is.
Yep.
Yeah. As someone who suffered from the infamous DLC agency character swipe,
oh, yeah.
I'm very grateful that this one seems to have gone out pretty smoothly.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Shit happens.
I want to say that the team did an awesome job on that, you know, both in Redmond and in Reading is reverse engineering that beast to make it work on people's drives. It was quite a challenge. They kicked ass.
Well, I think you guys have to move on to your next appointment. I would hold you here all day and we'd talk for 5 hours about stuff.
Can we bring them here? I'm quite comfy.
Yeah. Settling in now. Yeah.
Well, John swings by every now and again, so I think we can work something out. But for Peter, James, and John, very biblical names. I'm David, and I appreciate you guys coming by and chatting with us for a little bit, and looking forward to Crackdown 2.
Fantastic. Thanks very much
for
your time.
Thanks for having us, David.
Thanks, guys.
Great.
So, if you're still with us, that was Crackdown 2.
What do you mean, if you're still with us?
I know.
That interview was so good, I couldn't tune out.
People are so happy to hear you on mic again, they might have just fast-forwarded until they heard your baritone.
I don't know about that.
So,
I don't know.
Did you get
that.
A chance to sit through the Crackdown 2?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a good conversation. As a matter of fact, those guys do a podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of – what's the name of it?
John does the – the something biased system. I'm fucking it up.
System bias. Yes, which I have to add to my list because he's a cool dude.
Yeah.
And I want to check it out because it sounded like
a. Yeah, it's an official Microsoft podcast they do.
So the way he explained it was that they are sanctioned, mm-hmm. but they kind of do their own thing.
Yeah.
So that sounds cool. System bias. Check it out.
Of course, up till now, they've been small enough that they can kind of do whatever, but now some corporate overlord's going to download it one time and be like, what the hell? They use a Macintosh? But
nice.
Crackdown 2, for me, that was the biggest surprise coming out of TGS was seeing it, but also playing it. And then seeing it.
Wait, you're a huge Crackdown fan. Why is that a surprise?
We weren't expecting to be able to play it there at TGS.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm going back to TGS, but then X10.
Where we didn't get to play it.
Exactly. Well, some of us got to play it.
If you got in early
before all the lines showed up and the PR people were paying attention, some of us got to play it a little bit. But I will say it looks significantly better than what they showed in TGS. Like, seeing the helicopter flying around the city.
Helicopter looks fun. Helicopters are always fun.
Of it.
I mean, if you played Grand Theft Auto 4 multiplayer at all, you know, helicopter, big city equals fun.
Yeah.
Blow the hell out of everything, create mass chaos, and have a good time. And then the part that I thought was really cool was the tandem skydiving, which I guess you can do up to four people. So, like, everybody get up on the helicopter, fly up, like, screw the tall skyscrapers, go above them, and then jump. And then the flying suit thing, just you add those things together, and it looks like a lot of fun.
Justin, did you play the first Crackdown much?
I spent very little time with it. I did watch this demo, though. It's such a different looking game than the first one at all. It's such a much better looking game in so many ways.
Yeah, what's interesting, and some people were a little confused because they weren't allowing footage filming of the demo.
They weren't really allowing much footage of anything, which was kind of annoying at X10 there.
Well, I mean, it's always frustrating. It's like always a back and forth on what you can film versus what you can't. But for Crackdown, they released a ton of screenshots, and they actually James explained why the screenshots for Crackdown look way different than it in person. And the reason is anytime they do a screenshot, they take the screenshot in super high resolution and then shrink it back down. But inside the dev kit, when they blow it up to a really high resolution, that thick kind of dark line that kind of gives it a graphic novel look to the world and the characters.
The cell shade.
Yeah. But they don't like the term cell shade. But yeah, the thick bordering on everything, cell shade. It doesn't actually increase in width as they increase the resolution. So it actually shrinks that down and basically takes that effect away on screenshots. But if you like that in the first game and you want it in the second game, it's totally there. I mean, it's very consistent with the first game, but it's way more colorful too, I think.
I love the look of Crackdown, and this one really gets it for me. I agree that the coloration is one of the things that sets it apart for me. It's not dark. It's not dreary. It's not gritty. It has this super, super saturated, you called it comic book like, but it's almost more of a
super real
kind of. Yeah. It's not just your plain old cell shade that you've seen before every other time, because they're not. I don't know what part of the art vocabulary is what does that. I think part of it is the character designs. They're not, you know, there's not a lot of deformity. There's not a lot of super exaggeration. There's very many recognizable structures and detail elements in the city, and at the same time, it has that pop off the screen like you'd get in a graphic novel. So I think they hit I think they've hit a really good creative stride with it.
Yeah, and talking to the guys after the demo, they have a very aggressive plan for post-launch support of that game and actually adding a lot of new content. I mean, they added some really cool content to the first one.
That's a game that'll support it.
Yep.
And, I mean, there's no doubt about that.
And they're absolutely planning that. So, God, I can't wait to play Crackdown 2, although it's not coming in June, as was reported in the MPD response. That was a typo. It's probably not coming till late summer, early spring, or early fall. It probably is going to be a September release. But that's,
right. You just narrowed it down from probably, maybe, it's going to be fall.
Yeah, it is going to be fall. I mean, it's the only thing that makes sense. The only thing they'll say on the record is that it absolutely is, you'll be playing that game this year. So it's the only thing that makes sense for it. If you look at the other releases that are planned out, I think an August, September release makes a lot of sense for a game like Crackdown.
If it's ready. I don't see them rushing that out, because they have the cachet from the first game now of that having been a bigger success than I think they anticipated.
Yeah.
And this one tying in so well to their live strategy, because obviously online was the way everybody loved to play it. Mm-hmm. Co-oping in the game. Great. You know, if they do this thing right, they'll be able to push content into Crackdown 2 for at least 8 to 10 months,
yeah,
and carry it into, you know, summer of 2011.
Well, I mean, we've heard rumors that there's actually going to be two huge post-launch, almost on the level of like a old classic upgrade with like Borderlands is doing. They have their
old classic upgrade.
I'm trying to think of the term, and I'm like completely out of it because I've been up
expansion pack.
Expansion pack. That is the word. I can't believe I couldn't remember. You guys make fun of me. I'm falling apart here. I'm a shell of a human being at this point.
Oh my God, your finger just fell off. Are you a zombie, David Ellis?
I'm a freaks come out at night.
All right, so.
So that was Crackdown. So that's it. That's pretty much all the
Crackdown,
ones
lay the smackdown.
But there was a ton of other games there. So I turned it over to
you guys,
Justin.
Seem to have some, speaking of zombies, you guys seem to have some pretty strong opinions about Dead Rising 2 and the game play that they had on hand there.
All right. So I'm actually playing through Dead Rising 1. We talked about it last week on the podcast for the first time. I think it looks interesting. But, you know, like a 10-minute demo of a game like Dead Rising just doesn't do a good job of explaining what they're trying to do with
it. Look, I think one of the fundamental problems here is Japanese developers doing crazy, kitschy, goofy zombie versus Western developers doing crazy, over-the-top zombie. And in one case you get Dead Rising 1, which I loved for its just really eccentric, weird quirkiness. And in the other case, you get Dead Rising 2, which so far all I've seen thinks that it's very funny and clever to have just masses of zombies that you wade through and don't even have a lot of character. The fun of it is, oh, look at all the blood. Look at all the things I've chopped off.
It does seem to leak. I don't know. The first game was definitely violent, but it didn't seem to revel in the violence. And it seems like this one does. Maybe that makes sense story-wise in the setting and the way that it's going to play out. But you have to admit, throwing on a pair of assless chaps, beating a zombie to death with a dildo, which is called a personal massager in the game, it's a pretty fantastic experience, isn't it?
I'll leave you to your vices. That's all I'm going to say. I think the other problem I have is that without totally slagging the game, I look at the games, especially around a room like X10, and I go to Dead Rising 2, and the fidelity of the game production is just not on an even par with everybody else.
Well, even when you compare it to Lost Planet 2, which that game looks gorgeous. Did you get a chance to play
the animation's not as good. The detailing in the environments and in the characters is not as good. Especially the animations,
that's definitely true.
They're blocky. They're not there. You know,
They're not fluid.
It doesn't feel like it belongs in the same era.
Yeah.
And
I can see where you're coming at from that one.
Lost Planet I thought was really cool. I mean, the section they had was another co-op section.
Yeah.
And you're running through, you know, these weird jungle environments and the variety of
Did you get a chance to mess around with the other character models?
No, I didn't.
So they had the Marcus and Dom from
I saw them on the selection screen.
And Wesker. Yeah. They haven't confirmed whether they're actually going to record voice work for it, but I'd be shocked if they don't actually record some lines with those guys which is pretty cool.
Be fun.
Yeah. What else did you guys see that you thought was interesting?
There was another big Matt Leone game here. I wish he was here to speak about it more intelligently. But
Alone in the Dark.
Yeah, Alone in the Dark was.
I'm sorry. Alan Wake. I'm sorry.
You assless chap wearing dildo wielding troll.
You made Matt Leon cry.
Seriously.
Somewhere.
You can make me cry.
He's crying.
I kid. After seeing it, I have been making that claim for a while. It just did make me think of Alone in the Dark. The episodic stuff was reminiscent.
I understand. I get that. I think they're going to get that representation.
But also kind of just like the clunky – talking about kind of a clunky animation system. Just every – that character of Alan Wake running around just looks very stiff. But everyone I talk to –
no more so than like a Nathan Drake even.
Maybe.
Because I mean you have that same problem you have where you have a highly detailed environment, a highly detailed character, and then you give player control and you use an analog stick. And and basically, you know, if you push a little bit, it's walking. You push a little harder, he's walking a little faster. You push a little harder, he's starting to jog. You push a little harder, he's running. And you're right. There's not like a really good system of stitching between all those animations. And so I guess it's part of the uncanny divide, really.
But I think
because you start to recognize, oh, that doesn't really look right the way he changed stride there. And
I think ultimately what's going to make or break that game is going to be how it controls and whether the pacing is right, the combination of the combat that is there versus just basically running for your life and trying to stay alive.
Well, hands-on impressions coming in one more week, so.
Yeah, and I mean all I'll say is that everyone that was in line playing it, it was a pretty substantial line.
It was absolutely my favorite game that was there. You know, so just from the presentation that they showed us, I think the thing that should stand out to people is – this is very much an action game. Mm-hmm. An action game has a huge part of it. There is the exploratory part. They showed the daylight adventuring part some for the first time. They showed the arrival of when Alan and his wife get to Bright Falls. And,
right.
And it had a very, very David Lynchian sort of feel to it. I mean, complete down to the showing up in the diner.
You just need a lady with a log and a midget talking backwards and I'll be there.
If there was a lady with a log, that would be awesome. But they have this cool, weird, crazy old lady in the veil who gives him the key to the cottage, and they didn't show a lot of the exploration, and I have a suspicion that the exploration parts will not be particularly long.
Yeah.
But one of the things I was talking about Matthias about was how, you know, the action in this game is really intense, and it's fairly challenging looking. You know, you've got to use the light a lot. You don't know where things are coming from. There's dodge. There's lots of movement. Like it very much could get you on edge. And in order for that to work throughout the game, you have to have a little cool off. You have a little period to let people catch their breath, keep up with what's going on, or else you just, you know, if you get constantly sensory overloaded, you switch off.
So Alan Wake was your favorite game you saw there.
Absolutely.
Justin, what was your favorite game you saw?
It would be hard to say. I really had a favorite game.
But, yeah.
You know, Fable is what I spent the most time with. That's what I would – if I had been there personally, if I had not been there for work, that's what I would have gone to check out. And I would have been happy with what I saw.
We're all glazing over Final Fantasy XIII.
Well, I mean, there was another event earlier in the league.
So much inundated – like maybe, you know, because we are
so much
in the industry,
coverage
we have
as well.
So much of this. Like Jeremy has written 500,000 pages of that for our site.
Is it in Japanese or English?
I think you can Google translate it either way. I think it works.
That would be kind of fun. Actually, you know what would be fun would be to take Jeremy's previous stuff,
Translate
it to Japanese, and then translate it back to English.
Crispin used to do that all the time.
It's always fun.
Cracked us up. So.
Yeah, it's always fun. Yeah. I found that, you know, we had that demo down in LA last week before they brought it up here, and it was awesome for me to finally get my head around the way the combat system works.
Because Jeremy's a big fan of.
It's really cool now that I understand it. It's not like old Final Fantasy because it's not about picking your spells individually. It's about figuring out what the tactical situation you are in is at the moment and adjusting your job system. Your paragons, which are the three jobs, the combination of three jobs that you have in any given lineup and adjusting between those for the right situation. So maybe you have like a heavy heal lineup. So when you're down, you switch to that, or a heavy attack or a gambling. It's very cool juggling back and forth in the battles. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah. I mean, that was my first time seeing the 360 version. And Jeremy, you know, when they bought the Final Fantasy party bus by the office a couple of weeks ago, they had both versions. Like he said, looking back and forth, they were virtually indistinguishable. You know, differences, what system you got and whether you want to switch discs or not.
Yeah.
But I did say at the beginning of the year that I would play all the way through Final Fantasy 13 and I hope buy it. And it's just a gorgeous game to look at.
Definitely.
And so they definitely, you know, knocked that out. But a couple of other quick games. I got a chance to check out Splinter Cell, which I won't belabor too much because, you know, I don't know. What they showed was the beginning and it was kind of spoilery and I don't really want to talk about it in that context. But what I will say is that I've played it a few times and I'm totally used to controls. Longtime fans of the series probably will take you about 20 minutes to get used to the new control scheme because it is very different. And some people will probably make the complaint that the game holds your hand a little too much, but all the hand holding that's there is pretty much optional. You can choose to use that kind of mark and execute stuff, but you can also do it traditionally manually yourself and still take out enemies very efficiently in very cool ways. So the game gives you a lot of options there and how that's tied into it.
I'm just curious to know, I've always wanted to like Splinter Cell, and then every time it'll happen is I'll play a Splinter Cell and I'll get about a third of the way into it, and by that point I feel like I'm not doing it right, and I feel like I'm a dumbass playing the game, and I don't like that. As much as I like the game, feeling like there's this Ubisoft gremlin on my shoulder going, you're not doing it right. I'm just like, you know what? Screw it.
Well, I think, based on what I've played so far, it seems like Splinter Cell has never been more wide open to different play styles than in this game. It does get the option to be really stealthy. Now, I will say that the game really encourages you to kill people. You don't really have an option.
It does. So that for me is kind of easier because I understand that.
Yeah. There are some traditional fans of the series that actually are very adamantly against that. But they need to know going in, you're not going to necessarily have an option to not kill at least some people.
See, don't misinterpret what I was saying. I understand the appeal because I know people who are big Splinter Cell fans.
Yeah.
My stepdad is a huge Splinter Cell fan, and he adores the whole mechanic of being super stealthy, staying out of view, and having to work to make all those encounters work out the way they're supposed to. For me, I tend to get frustrated, and the fails just happen, And they suck the life out of me.
Yeah. Did you guys get a chance to see Perfect Dark at all, the XBLA version? Looks pretty cool.
It's the way it was supposed to.
I know.
There you go. That was the way that game was envisioned. Rare, pioneering games 8 years later.
But at the very least, they're finally learning the right price point for those types of games.
So what is the price point for that going to be?
$10 or 800 J-Allards.
800 J-Allards?
Yeah. Space bucks.
I tell you what, my 800 J-Allards will go to definitely go to Toy Soldiers.
Yeah.
Because that shit looks fun.
I saw it at CES and had a lot of fun with it. And the cool thing is they're actually releasing today on Facebook. Microsoft built a Facebook game that actually ties in with Toy Soldiers.
Oh, really? That's smart.
Yeah.
And Scrap Metal's really fun.
Scrap Metal's really cool in a very calling out cars, RC Pro-Am.
It's RC Pro-Am. It's RC Pro-Am with twisted metal.
With physics, damaging stuff into it. Yeah. So it looked really cool. And Game Room. I think a lot of people were digging Game Room, getting their hands on with it. Ryan O'Donnell, him and Jason Bertrand ended up playing Game Room for like almost an hour straight, just going through all these old Intellivision games and just having a lot of fun with it. I still think the pricing model is a little off on that. But
especially if you've already bought some of these games and then you have to buy them again.
Especially when you can buy like a compilation.
And by a little, you mean it's fucking nuts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, especially when you can buy like a compilation like 50 Atari games for like $10. And these are charging like $30 or $3 a piece.
And I think they'll still be successful with it because the ease of distribution and the way it's set up will pull people in.
Yeah. I mean, I went back and bought Dead Rising on Games on Demand for $20 when I probably could have picked it up for $10 on Amazon.
You probably could have picked it up for $5.
Probably. So I think that's everything for X10. I know, Garnet, you got to get over to another appointment. But
I'm going. You can listen to me also on Bitmob. So it's great. I have no personal microphone. I just go steal other people's microphones.
Nothing wrong with that. You ain't got to pay for it then. Not that you were paying for it before.
Yeah. I didn't buy this stuff.
So, well, Garnet, always a pleasure, bud. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Justin, thanks for coming in
as well. Thanks for having me on.
And yes, there will be a show coming soon.
So X10, I think, it had its issues, kind of disorganized, but it was a lot of fun, a lot of good stuff coming out of it. And like I said, on last week's episode, next week, Sam and I are going to be at DICE. We plan on doing a show there. And week after, I'm actually going to be in Japan, and we'll probably hopefully be recording a podcast with Mark McDonald, John McCarty, and the 8-4 guys. So
awesome.
Next couple of weeks, I'm getting a lot of travel mileage. So that's a good thing. So until then, we'll see you next time.